But the Bible teaches in these passages, and the ones we'll look at in a moment in the book of Revelation, that the time is coming when there will be another world empire. And it will be under the head and under the authority of this little horn, who is known elsewhere as, let's say, the Antichrist, as the beast, as the man of sin. And he will come to power, according to this passage, at least partially by force. I think that's the only way we can take it when it says that the little horn uprooted three of the other horns, and then, in effect, as we see in the book of Revelation in a moment, had the voluntary cooperation of the remainder. Now, this is rather intriguing, because we don't want to speculate too far beyond what Scripture warrants here. But if the Antichrist, or the little horn here, eventually comes to power, partially at least, by virtue of force, then I think that we can speculate with some biblical basis that there will be some coercion involved, and that his eventual empire will not be entirely a diplomatic thing. Now, we'll say more about this as we go on, but I think it is at least conceivable that the empire of the beast, or the Antichrist, or of the little horn, will come about in no small measure because of the military superiority of this man and the country or the nation which he represents, which he controls. Now, there are various ways this could come about. I don't think it's too hard to visualize. At the end of World War II, the United States had the capability of ruling the world if it wanted to. At that time, we had the atom bomb and nobody else did. And if we had wanted to, we could have made the entire inhabited earth capitulate to us, just as Japan did when they saw the force of the bomb. You know that's a fact. If we'd wanted to, if we'd had totalitarian interests, we could have become a world empire at the close of World War II because of the weapon which we controlled and which at that time was unique. Now, that situation has changed today, of course, and it's very difficult for some of us to adjust to the situation. We have lived in a nation now for nearly 200 years, which for the most part has usually been able to get its way because if people didn't do what we wanted them to do, we'd hit them. You know? I mean, I'm not saying that we were totalitarian, but when other nations were in some sort of a controversy with us, we could exercise an awful lot of muscle, and they knew eventually that that we probably could defeat them militarily if we cared to, and therefore people respected us and feared us to some degree, and when we spoke, people listened, just like you know the old saying about where does the 600-pound gorilla sleep in the zoo? The answer is he sleeps wherever he wants to, friend, the 600-pound gorilla. And therefore, as long as we were the mightiest nation on the face of the earth, we pretty well had our way. It's difficult for us to adjust to the fact that it isn't that way anymore. That a couple of other big kids have moved in on the block, and they have the same capabilities we do, and if we can believe what we read, their capabilities are even beginning to exceed ours, and therefore we aren't quite in the same position we used to be. But carrying this on, isn't it conceivable in the setup in which we now find ourselves that one of these nations could gain such a superiority militarily over the others that they could actually dominate the world and tell people, in effect, surrender or we'll destroy you? Now, it could come just through the multiplying of current weapons. Or, and I think myself this is perhaps more probable, through the development of still another weapon, which at that day and time would have the same effect worldwide as the development of the atom bomb, the Manhattan Project, close of World War II. Who is to say that nuclear fission is the last and final and deadliest of all the weapons? There may be other weapons, and we hear little rumblings about death rays and all sorts of germ warfare and all the rest of it, which are almost too horrible to contemplate. But if the time arrives when one nation has the control of a weapon which at its discretion could destroy the rest of humanity, then it could very well be that the rest of humanity will have very little choice but to succumb, to capitulate. Now, I'm not saying that that's exactly how it will happen, but it seems to me that something like that is implied here by the fact that the little horn uproots three, and then the rest of them fall in line. That's so similar to what I've just been talking about that it seems to me that that's probably what it means. Now, let's leave the Old Testament and turn over to the book of Revelation, chapter 13. We'll have the overhead repaired during lunchtime, so we'll once again be in full color this afternoon, but in the meantime, we'll limp along. Actually, I think to save time here, instead of drawing all of these animals for you out of Daniel 7, that I may forego that at the moment because our time is running a little short. And I'm a little sensitive about this anyhow, because the last time I drew this leopard on the blackboard, everybody said it looked more like an anteater than a leopard anyhow. And therefore I swore that I'd never draw one again. But at any rate, perhaps your imagination of what a leopard with four wings and four heads would look like might be more vivid than my anteater type anyhow. So maybe we'll pass that up for the moment. In the 13th chapter of Revelation, the Apostle John on the island of Patmos is now given a series of visions, and this particular one, which we're looking at the moment, is directly parallel and carries on the visions that we've seen in the book of Daniel. Perhaps the best translation here in chapter 13 is that he stood upon the sand of the sea. And the he here in context would be the dragon of the previous verse in chapter 12, which is defined as Satan. And thus the picture here seems to be that it is Satan who summons this beast out of the sea to do his bidding. So this beast rises up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns. And upon his head the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth is the mouth of a lion. And the dragon, who is defined as Satan, gave him his power and his seat or his throne and great authority. Now before we go on, I want you to notice the similarity between this beast and the four beasts of Daniel chapter 7. This beast is said to be like a leopard. And this, of course, is the third beast. The leopard was the third beast in Daniel 7. This beast that John saw had feet like a bear. And the bear was the second animal in Daniel chapter 7, the Media-Persian Empire. And furthermore, his mouth was as the mouth of a lion, and the lion was the first beast in Daniel chapter 7, the Babylonian Empire. Therefore, what John sees is a beast which is the composite of the four beasts that Daniel saw in the book of Daniel. In other words, the Roman Empire, which John is now facing in his day, is the composite. It is the culmination of all of these empires which have gone before. It carries on the tradition. It carries on the power. It carries on the whole emphasis of these previous empires. And now, in composite form, they're all rolled up into this beast which John sees. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon which gave power unto the beast, that's Satan. And they worshiped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. There's the reference to the little horn out of Daniel 7 that I referred to earlier. I said we would run on to that same expression later on in the book of Revelation. So this, I think, makes it certain that this man, whom John is describing here, is one and the same with the little horn that we saw in Daniel chapter 7. Notice how the apocalyptic writers shift back and forth between a man and his empire. Sometimes the horn represents an empire, sometimes it represents the emperor. Sometimes the beast represents the empire, sometimes the beast represents the emperor. They seem to be one in the prophet's view. Verse 5, there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. That's the same 3.5 years which was stated in terms of the time and times and the dividing of times in Daniel chapter 7. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And you remember that was in Daniel 7 also. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. In other words, he becomes a world ruler. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Now notice two things. This beast will become, number one, a world ruler in the political sense, and number two, he will become recognized as deity in the religious sense. And this, of course, is parallel to the career of some of the early Roman emperors, who not only were in effect world rulers in their day, but also were regarded by the people as being gods. And the emperor worship was quite prevalent in the early Christian centuries. And therefore, this is not totally foreign to John and his readers. They have seen some evidences of this already in their day. Now, this beast, this little horn, this man who is described as the Antichrist, and incidentally, it comes as a surprise to some to know that the book of Revelation never speaks of the term Antichrist. You have to go to 1st and 2nd John, the epistles of John, to find that terminology. But the person is here, even though that particular terminology is not used in the book of Revelation. This beast, then, is a world ruler who comes to power and is eventually recognized as deity. Now, we can't take time here to go into all of the intricacies of this section of Revelation. For example, when it talks about one of the heads being wounded to death and the deadly wound was healed, there are differences of interpretation here as to exactly what this means. There are some who feel that the Antichrist receives some sort of a wound, some sort of a fatal wound, and is actually restored to life by Satan, and thus becomes the object of wonder by the whole world. There are others who feel that the deadly wound here refers to the empire rather than to the emperor, and that the restoration of this deadly wound refers to in effect to the restoration of the ancient Roman Empire, to putting together a world empire which is very much like the ancient empire. Are still others, and I tend toward this view myself, see the reference here as being the reference to a prevailing legend of that day. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the book of Revelation is a legend. But I'm saying that it's possible that John was referring here to a well-known legend of the day concerning the fact that Nero, the infamous Nero, who apparently had died, was actually not dead, but was simply living in the east beyond the Euphrates, and would in time return in power to Rome and would once again rule the Roman Empire. This is called by scholars the Nero Redivivus myth, the revived Nero myth. And lest you think, well, that's the strangest thing I ever heard of. How could a bunch of intelligent people believe something like that? All I can say is look at the Hitler Redivivus myth, which has been going on now ever since the end of World War II. And surely you're aware of the fact that even still, but particularly for the first 20, 25 years, there were constant reports coming out that Hitler actually had survived the fire in the Reichstag and that he'd escaped to Argentina and that he was hiding out and that when the Fourth Reich was finally established, he would be brought back to power and so on. This is the type of myth that was going around in the days of John concerning Nero. And it's just possible, and I rather think this myself, it's just possible that he was making reference to this, not that he believed it, not that he was giving credence to it, but simply taking a well-known fiction of the day and saying, in effect, that this man that he's talking about, this Antichrist, this beast, is going to be a Nero-like figure, which for his Christian readers would say volumes. That would tell it all. But then you might ask, well, why would he have to be so cryptic? Why would he have to be so secretive about this? Why didn't he just come out and say this guy is going to be like Nero? Well, you must remember that these letters, and this is a letter, sometimes fell into the wrong hands. And therefore, it's possible that John was guarding his language here so as not to present something which would be found treasonous in case this letter fell into the hands of the Roman authorities. That, I think, is the reason why the Apostle Paul is so cryptic in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 when he speaks of that which now restrains being removed. I think he had good reason to speak in that terminology because if he comes right out and says that the Roman Empire, as it is then known, will one day pass away, and we'll come back to that later on today, that could have been taken as a seditionous statement. As a seditious statement or as a treasonous statement, and he and his converts who possessed his letters could have been brought to trial over a statement like that. We'll mention that later. Now turn over to chapter 17 of the book of Revelation. Chapter 17. We have some more information about this same beast that John sees. Let me summarize a little of the first part of the chapter here, for lack of time. Most of you are familiar with this passage. John here sees the vision of this same beast, which he has just been describing in chapter 13. But now, in addition to the beast, which has seven heads and ten horns, there is a woman sitting on top of the beast. A woman arrayed in purple and scarlet, verse 4, decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication, and upon her forehead there is a name written, which is Mystery, comma, Babylon the Great. Now that comma is very important there, because mystery means here is a symbol which must be understood by those reading. As we saw earlier, a mysterion means something which can be revealed only by God, something which takes spiritual understanding to understand. Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. That's the name of this woman. She's drunken with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs. John marveled at her. Admiration there in verse 6 in the King James means amazement, not admiration in our sense. And then in verse 7, the angel says, I will explain to you what this means. Now verse 8, the beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the abyss. Now that's the same reference to the deadly wound which was healed. And however you interpret that, that's what it means here again. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is. Let me pause here just a moment and take you back to chapter 13, something which we did not read. There's a second beast in chapter 13, starting in verse 11, who is sort of the high priest of the first beast. He exercises the power of the first beast, and he causes the people of the earth to worship the first beast. And verse 13 says, he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. Just in passing, let me mention this. One of the characteristics of the end time, of the last days, is that the forces of evil, culminating eventually in Antichrist and his high priest, one of the things that will characterize this time is deception, false miracles, culminating even in fire coming down from heaven to earth. And Jesus, you remember, said in the Olivet Discourse, which we'll look at this afternoon, that if it were possible, the deception will be so great that if it were possible, even the very elect would be deceived. I think it behooves us as Christians today to be on the lookout for false miracles, because this is going to be one of the signs of the end time. And if we should be living in the end days, and I'll have more to say about that this afternoon, if we should be living in that time, we would find it, we would expect it to be characterized by false miracles and deception on every hand. And I fear that when the ultimate deception comes, that it will be just exactly as Scripture says, that people will be sucked in by the millions, because they're already being sucked in by the millions by lesser miracles. It is commonly believed today by most that a man who can perform a miracle must be of God. We seem to be so naive on this score. We read somewhere about a miracle that took place. We don't even know whether it took place or not. But even if it did, we are immediately ready to put that down to the working of God, because we seem to have the idea that only God can perform miracles through his servants. That is absolutely not true. And we need to read Scripture. Do you remember the days when Moses was in Egypt and he was in the court of Pharaoh, and God had already taught him in the wilderness, you know, at the burning bush, that he could take his rod and throw it down on the ground and become a serpent? And so he was all primed for Pharaoh. And when Pharaoh wouldn't let the people go, Moses took the rod and threw it down on the ground and became a serpent, just like God said it would, just like it happened back at the burning bush. But to Moses' astonishment, some of the magicians of Egypt threw their rods down and they became serpents too. Remember that? I'd give anything if I could have seen the look on Moses' face when that happened. You could almost hear Moses saying, Lord, you didn't tell me that was going to happen. Snakes all over the place. Now, it's true that his snake ate up the other snakes and so on. And it's true that as the miracles went on, the magicians finally fell by the wayside. They couldn't duplicate them all, but they duplicated some of them. Now, what do you suppose would be the ultimate miracle that would make people go after you? No, I think it would be fire from heaven. Wouldn't that be the ultimate miracle? What was the great test in the Old Testament of reality? Why, it was the great confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. They set up all the altars, and finally they all prayed, and the God that answers with fire from heaven, he's God. Jehovah said, or Elijah said, if Jehovah be God, let's serve him. If Baal be God, let's serve him. But let's have it out today, and the God that answers with fire, that's it. But it says here in chapter 13 that the false prophet will make fire come down from heaven on the earth. And I think we could maybe do a little sanctified speculation there and wonder if maybe he doesn't set up some sort of a presumed operation very much like Elijah's. And this fire from heaven is to be the proof that he represents Almighty God. And I guarantee if somebody appeared in Dallas, Texas today and could produce fire from heaven, the people would go after him in such multitudes that you wouldn't believe it. Well, then what is the final criterion? If fire from heaven can't tell us who's true and who's false, then how on earth will we ever know? And the answer is we'll know from this book. That's how. This book is the only final reliable guide as to what is right and what is wrong, who is true and who is false, and what movements are of God and what movements aren't. And I don't care if a man stands right out in front of this church on Garland Road and makes fire come down from heaven. If he denies that Jesus is the Christ, he isn't of God, I don't care how much fire he produces. A man who is unbiblical in his teaching is still unbiblical and is still not of God, regardless of what sort of real or imagined miracles he may be able to produce. We ought to remember that. Now, it says here in this passage, back in chapter 17 now, middle of verse 8, that the people who dwell on the earth shall wonder, shall marvel, because of all of this miraculous goings on. When they behold the beast. And some take it that his presumed resurrection here is the miracle which makes them marvel. And that's entirely possible. I'm not ruling out that possibility, although I don't take that interpretation myself. But now, here is the mind which hath wisdom, verse 9. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. In other words, the seven heads represent two different things in this imagery. They represent the seven mountains on which the woman sits, which can hardly be missed as referring to Rome. Particularly when you take verse 18, the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Rome, the city of the seven hills. And we have abundant evidence, even from the literature of the first century, that it was even then known as the city of the seven hills. So this would be a description that no one in John's day or since should miss. But that's not all. It represents something else. There are seven kings, verse 10, or kingdoms. Five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seventh, and goeth into perdition. Now, since that's self-explanatory, we'll just skip over that and go on. No, I'm kidding. That's a tough passage. It really is. There are a number of different views here. Many commentators try to make out these kings to be the successive Roman emperors in John's own day, but I've been through all the lists, and I can't quite see it. Some say that number one is Augustus, and number two is Tiberius, and number three is Gaius, and number four is Claudius, and number five is Nero, and then number six is Vespasian, and number seven is Titus, and finally the eighth who comes out of the other is Domitian, who reigned at the time of John. But that doesn't quite hold up, because if you look very closely, they skipped a few. And the ones that they pass over, such as Galbo and so on, they say, well, he wasn't emperor long enough to count. But I don't know. You know, that strikes me a little bit strange. Furthermore, in order to do this, you have to say that the book of Revelation was actually written at the time of Nero rather than in the days of Domitian, which is the usually accepted date. And the whole thing seems to me breaks down very badly. So although I'm not dogmatic at this point, I rather think that the seven heads here, or the seven kings, represent the great empires that the world has seen, going back even beyond the visions of Daniel, going all the way back to Egypt, then followed by Assyria, and then picking up the four empires that Daniel saw, Babylon, Media Persia, Greece, Rome. That would be six empires. And that would explain, perhaps, what John means here when he says that five, verse 10, there are seven kings, five are fallen. That would be Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Media Persia, Greco-Macedonia. Those five are off the scene. They're past. One is. That would be the current Roman Empire of John's day in the first century. Then there's another coming. One more to come. That would be the final amalgamation, the final empire, out of which, out of the ten horns, up in the middle of the ten horns, arises the Antichrist. And his kingdom, in effect, is a separate kingdom which arises out of the seventh kingdom and becomes the last kingdom, the eighth, and goeth into perdition. Seems to me that that fits better than other interpretations that I'm aware of, but I put that forth with probability, but not certainty. Now, very quickly, before we break for lunch, the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings. These are the same horns that you saw back in Daniel. They're the same as the ten toes back in Daniel 2. The ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings which have received no kingdom as yet. Now, there's some who take these ten kings as being a succession of kingdoms, but John won't allow that. He says these are kings who have received no kingdom as yet, and therefore, as of the final decade of the first century A.D., the ten kings are not yet in existence. John says so. But they will receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. In other words, they will exist for a relatively short time in the days of Antichrist. They have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. And when you connect this with Daniel 7, apparently part of the persuasion for giving their power and authority to the beast is his might and his power. These then shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the great harlot sits, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, and then we should add here from the better text, and the beast, these shall hate the harlot, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. Now we're going to have to break here and pick up at this point and go on after lunch. But let me just say this much before we do. The ten kings represent kingdoms. I am not certain myself whether the number ten is to be taken literally or not. Ten is frequently used as the number of completion, of totality in Scripture. And therefore, whether the ten is to be significant as a specific number, or whether the ten is taken simply from the fact that people have ten toes on their feet, and thus is used as a symbolism of the totality, at any rate, there is to be a world empire made up of kingdoms, over which eventually the beast, the Antichrist, becomes a ruler. Originally, and I believe that's what the woman represents here, and I'll say a little bit more of this after lunch. Originally, the great world philosophical religious system supports this man. This is pictured by her riding on his back. But eventually, when the beast proclaims himself as God, and when he is worshipped as God, and causes the whole world to worship him, every religious group on earth will be outlawed except the religion of the beast, and this will involve even the great religious, moral, ethical, sociological system, which I think is represented here by the great harlot. And that, I believe, is what is meant by her destruction by the beast and his associates. And then the beast will reign unhindered, unchallenged, until, as we'll see after lunch, the Lord himself returns and destroys him with the brightness of his coming. Now, we're leading up to the very center of our study and the very heart of it. So I hope, if at all possible, you can make arrangements to be back with us at 2 o'clock when we'll pick up at this point and go on.